I'm Stephen Steigman, and this is Up to Date. The comic strip Doonesbury has tackled some controversial and important social and political issues over the years, including missing weapons of mass destruction and the debate over ending the 17-year Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on gays serving in the military. 42 years ago, the first Doonesbury strip appeared in newspapers, and 2 years ago, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Gary Trudeau released a retrospective of his best work. Today, in an interview from 2010, Steve Kraske talks with Gary Trudeau about how he keeps track of his sprawling comic strip replete with a cast of 60 characters. We'll also speak with collaborator and Fairway resident Don Carlton, who inks Trudeau's strip. We'll get you up to date following this hour's news.
Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It weighs in at 10 pounds, 6 ounces, and I know that because I just carried it in across the street from the parking lot. It's 696 pages, and here's the incredible thing. This new book, A Doonesbury Retrospective, covers just 13% of the more than 14,000 published strips. Yes, Doonesbury has turned 40 years old, but 4 decades later, the strip now appears in nearly 1,400 daily and Sunday newspapers in this country and abroad. In 1975, Gary Trudeau became the first comic strip artist ever to be awarded a Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. Trudeau has written columns for the New York Times and essays for Time magazine. He's received honorary degrees from Yale, Colgate, Duke, and 25 other universities and colleges, and he's been inducted as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And yet, Gary Trudeau has been called the most famous unknown American. That's about to change as Gary Trudeau joins us here this morning. And welcome to Kansas City, Gary.
Oh, thanks so much,
Nice
Steve.
To have you. So you mean to tell me if I shell out big bucks to buy this book, I get only 13% of all your strips?
I'm afraid so. It is almost 700 pages, and as you point out, it's pretty heavy. We do advise anyone who picks up this book to have someone spot them.
Yeah.
You know, we for a while we considered marketing it with four little legs, screwing legs for the corners
and a motor probably
coffee,
too.
Coffee table book. Yeah. Right.
So when do volumes 2, 3, and 4 come out?
Well, this is it. I think it's possible that down the road there'll be a complete set, but I think unlikely. I've moved away from that in the assembling of this book because I realized just how perishable most of the stuff is.
Yeah.
So we really were quite brutal in taking an axe to it. It seemed like too many of the strips were dependent on remembering the specifics of a particular political and social events. And so what we tried to do was shape the storylines, the character arcs, leaving in some context, but mostly getting rid of all the things that were likely to be unfamiliar, mm-hmm. particularly to younger readers. There's nothing worse than annotated humor.
Yeah.
I mean, if you...
It takes the humor out.
It takes the humor out.
Hey, does it feel like it's been 40 years? Or maybe after having gone through all the strips again, maybe
it does. Oh, sure. I got some miles on me. You know, it's 14,000 strips and it feels that way, yeah.
A lot of stuff has happened over those years. As you went through them all again, what stood out? Any sort of anything surprising as you look back over all those years?
No, not so surprising. The some of the strips were a total surprise because I didn't remember writing them. And some of them did not make earlier books, so they were long forgotten. When I do the strip, I'm doing it in such a frenzy that I don't really have. I think it just goes into the short-term memory, and then it's often lost because I'm on to the next thing.
You dedicated this book to your wife, Jane Pauley. Why?
Oh my goodness!
I mean, why not? Maybe
I dedicate it to my wife. Yes. She has been. We've been together for 35 of those 40 years, mm-hmm. and I don't think it would have been possible to have a career like this without someone who's incredibly understanding and supportive. Anyone in a deadline-driven business is absent a lot of the time. And you need somebody who understands that and you know, cares enough about your happiness and doing the work you want to make it work. And, you know, Jane has never faltered.
How often, how much of a sounding board is she for you?
None at all.
Really?
She's not around when I'm doing it, and I have to do it so quickly that it's almost impossible for me to have any kind of sounding board. I don't run my ideas by anyone. The first person to see them is my editor.
You know, you mentioned that she doesn't see anything and you have to move quickly at times. It's been said of you that you oftentimes end up on a Friday, beginning of the day, having not drawn very much in the preceding 4 days. Your deadline day is Friday. You have to produce a whole week's worth in one day. You don't like deadlines.
No, I'm a great procrastinator, but in that sense, I probably found the career that that suited me temperamentally. That's how I get stuff done. Mm-hmm. I need that kind of crushing burden to move forward. And yeah, I spend the first part of the week kind of marinating in ideas, reading a lot. The actual drawing is a relatively small part of what I do, and it is done in a frenzy at the great expense of my long-suffering associate Don Carlton, who has to ink what I draw.
He's sitting next to you. He's from Faraway, and he'll be joining us in our second half today. But you've also said that you begin sometimes on that Friday not really knowing where you're going. You just start moving.
Right.
That's got to be kind of unsettling.
It is. Somebody asked me yesterday if I ever was totally blocked and had no ideas, and the answer, of course, is yes, of course, and thanks for not noticing.
Yeah. and sometimes it's got to be, do you get to the end of Friday and you don't have it?
No, always have it.
You always
have
it.
Something.
Yeah.
I do have breaks. Some years back in the mid-90s, two great, great strips, The Far Side and Calvin and Hobbes, both came to an abrupt halt when their creators felt a little burned out in the space of a year. They both work for Universal Press, my syndicate.
Mm-hmm.
And Lee Salem, our editor, thought long and hard about what he might do to make sure this didn't happen in the future, that artists, you know, had the space to take some time off. Because up until that time, comics were really thought of as a kind of public utility.
Mm-hmm.
They were there 24/7, 365. We just had to continue to provide that service, if you will. And it's a little rough on family life and on creators. So what Lee did was he went to the board and said, everybody else in the company has vacations. Why don't the creators?
That's interesting.
That seems like the place that vacation.
So how much do you get
indispensable.
Now?
So now I get 4 to 6 weeks because I'm an old timer. I've been, you know, now I'm turning into Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
You know, I just
no one will ever get that back.
But that was a tremendous, you know, when I brought that news home, there were great cheers because up until then I'd had to tuck the work in around family life. And I have three children, and that wasn't always easy. We'd go on vacations. I'd have to get up really early or stay mm-hmm. up really late and try to work on the margins.
We're visiting with Doonesbury's Gary Trudeau. You've stirred the pot a lot over the years. Does your arm ever get tired?
Well, I mean, you mean that figuratively.
Of course.
The controversy that followed me around, that swirled around the strip for the first 25 years, was exhausting. In fact, one of the reasons that I kind of retired as a public person was because it was hard to manage it. It was
mm-hmm.
When I was first starting out, we gained a client list of several hundred papers quite early, but the strip would get banned from time to time, seemingly quite regularly in the early years. And each time that happened, it was a major distraction because the client newspaper would have their reporter call me for comment, and sometimes it made national news. And I started thinking sort of defensively, you know, how am I going to defend the strip before it even published it?
Hmm.
And I thought, that's not a good, you know, addition to my creative process. So I just stepped back from that and found that it made no difference in my career because it's an odd art form. It doesn't need to be promoted. It's there in people's papers, whether they want to read it or not.
And that's why you haven't talked, given tons of interviews over the years, some, but not lots.
Right. It's not because I'm particularly shy and I have a great many journalist friends. I love talking, but it had become out of control, and I really needed to back off the big distraction.
Let's run some of these Doonesbury controversies by you, Gary, and get your reaction to them, because some of them are really amazing, at least by today's standards. July 1974, a dozen papers refused to run the strip because you portrayed reporter Rick Redfern living with runaway housewife Joni Caucus without marriage. Looking back on that today, that's something.
Well, I guess so. They were both unmarried at the time, and the reveal that they had been colleagues working on either side of a campaign in 76, I think it was, and they knew each other, and they were sort of slowly falling in love, and then Joni decides to play her hand, and this is on a Monday, and the last frame of the sequence is the phone ringing in her a friend of hers calling her, and the phone ringing in her bedroom, but her bedroom's empty. And then over the next 3 days, there was a long panning shot that went out the window across town and finally through the curtains of Rick's bedroom, and there are the two of them lying in bed in a postcoital position. And newspaper editors had no idea what to do with that, particularly the 3 days that preceded it, because there were 3 days of dialogue-less traveling shot through the bucolic countryside. I mean, it was hardly objectionable. But what it was, it amounted to foreplay for this Thursday cartoon. So many of them dropped all 4 days. The reaction from their readers tended to be pretty negative. In Boston, the Boston Globe dropped it. There was a group of MIT students that picketed the Globe with signs that said, "We forgive you, Joni." There was another editor who explained himself to his readers by saying, I thought it was two dudes in bed, and which I thought was a rather severe comment on Joni's appearance. And then the one that I thought was the most imaginative was that in the last panel, through the curtains, instead, this was the Bangor Maine paper, instead of seeing this tableau of a couple, of a loving couple, they ran that day's weather forecast.
Did that reaction surprise you? I mean, did you know what you were getting yourself into when you put that together?
No, I think editors thought so. I think they thought I intentionally enjoyed putting sticks in their eyes and giving them putting them in a difficult position where if they ran it, they got grief, and if they didn't run it, they got grief.
And did you?
Pardon me?
Do you like putting sticks in
editors'
eyes?
No. And I actually spent a fair amount of energy calling editors and writing editors and trying to soothe feathers because, after all, they're the clients. I mean, yeah. I wasn't really in the business of getting knocked out of papers. I wanted to get into papers. So I was trying to find the balance, that would, sure, push the envelope, but at the same time, remain in newspapers, because if I'm not in, how am I going to reach people with those ideas?
10 years later, October 1984, Gary, the Deseret News of Salt Lake City pulls three strips that portray God as a member of Ronald Reagan's reelection committee.
Really?
Yes. That's what.
Gosh, I wish I remembered that.
Yeah. You don't remember that
No,
one?
No, I don't remember that one. That one didn't make it into the book.
Interesting idea, God as a member of Ronald Reagan's reelection committee.
Right. I can see where I was coming from, but I'm afraid I can't discuss the particulars with you.
November 84, papers drop Doonesbury election eve strips titled The Mysterious World of Ronald Reagan's Brain, which portray him as almost senile.
That's well, we don't actually see him. What we see is a pith-helmeted Roland Headley, my intrepid correspondent, taking a tour of his brain, which he so enjoyed that he came back later, 4 years later, for return for Reagan's brain, where he found his initials that he'd scratched on Reagan's brainstem, and that time he took Porter's and Sherpas as he made his way through the brain, which had become deeply calcified, and it was a very dangerous, threatening environment. And the Sherpas eventually abandoned him, There's all these loose synapses firing, and at some point Reagan tries to hold two thoughts in his brain at the same time, and which knocks Roland unconscious, and he has to be medevaced out. We never actually see Reagan. We offstage we hear the First Lady, who's described as she mommy, this monstrous presence that Roland has to get by. In search of the
Where did that idea come from? This idea of walking through Ronald Reagan's brain.
I don't know. I mean, I must have seen that classic Raquel Welch movie. I've forgotten what it's called now.
Couldn't have been too classic. Then.
Where they inject a little capsule with little
miniature
people into the body of. I can't remember the name of it, but I think that movie had a deep impact on me.
June 95, a handful of papers refused to run strips that show Frank Sinatra hobnobbing with well-known mob figures. Sinatra threatened to sue you. Did he ever?
No. He sent I think he had an attorney who was on retainer who sent a sort of a boilerplate letter. That the syndicate sent to me. It said something like, Mr. Trudeau has misrepresented the events of such and such a time at such and such a casino. And the syndicate called me, my editor called me and said, well, what about it? And he said, yeah, of course I misrepresented the facts. I made them up. And this wasn't going to go to trial. And, you know, it's a comic strip. But I think his job had been just to sort of rattle our cage. I think it was pretty pro forma. I don't think they probably ever felt they had much of a case.
Did that bother you? Did it scare you?
Well, it scared my wife. I think she felt that Sinatra wasn't somebody to mess around with, and certainly there were plenty of stories to suggest that might be the case. One interesting response came from the man himself during a concert he gave in Carnegie Hall. And the audience was a hometown audience. Remember, he grew up in Hoboken.
Sure.
And I'm sure he was a much beloved figure, and he was giving a concert, in the latter part of his life. And he just suddenly started talking about the strips. He didn't name me, but he said that cartoonist is as funny as a tumor. And then the audience was kind of egging him on and cheering. And then he made a huge mistake, which was he started attacking my wife.
Really?
And the audience was stunned because he's breaking the first rule of the neighborhood. You don't go after the women and children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they booed him. And I doubt he's ever had that experience in his career.
You know, in the late 80s, your strip on George H.W. Bush was putting his manhood in a blind trust. And the Bush family had some strong reactions to that. I've read that at a political convention, I believe, Jeb Bush confronted you at one point and sort of put his finger in your face. What did he say to you?
He said, walk softly. And I didn't actually hear it at the time. It was a very noisy room. It was at the Republican convention. And so I just smiled and shook his hand and kept moving. And later, I think Tom Brokaw had been standing there, and he asked him at some point a few days later what he had said, and he said, walk softly. Well, you know, that's just encouragement for me.
It didn't discourage you at all.
No, God, no.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, the various Bushes have dealt with this complicated relationship I have with them in different ways. Senior Bush actually talked about it much too much. It gave the strip and me a kind of dignity that otherwise would not have been entitled to. And he would, on the campaign trail, he would just unprompted go after me.
So clearly you got under his skin.
In 1992. Yeah, clearly got under his skin. I think this was among the hundreds of lessons that his son learned in watching his father's presidency, because he was quite famously disciplined in not mentioning by name any reporters while he was president, and never heard a on the record, off the record comment from him thereafter. He might have said something at one point when he was governor of Texas, but
you're
never
talking about W now.
I'm talking about W now, that he never actually identified his enemies in the media.
Your relationship with the family is complicated, at least in part, because you and W go back, way back to Yale days. And I believe if it wasn't your first cartoon, one of your first cartoons went after George W. Bush at Yale.
Right. It was my debut in the college paper was a series of illustrations that had been commissioned by the newspaper's magazine, which at that time was doing a fair amount of investigative reporting. And they did a cover story on a fraternity scandal. The fraternity that W belonged to, Deke, was involved in a branding incident. They were branding their initiatives with red hot coat irons, the Delta into their mm-hmm. backside. So we put a photograph of a branded backside on the front, covered the magazine, and inside I did a series of cartoons about it.
How did he react to that?
Well, I could be totally wrong about this, but the piece caused quite a stir, and it aroused the interest of local media. And the New York Times called him, and he downplayed it, said, oh, it's like a cigarette burn. But I think it may well have been his first interview in the national media, and wonderfully enough, of course, it concerned his defense of torture.
That's interesting. You have said that when you first broke in and Richard Nixon was president, that was a gold mine. That was a ticket to heaven for a new comic strip writer coming right out of the gate. I'm wondering, how does Barack Obama and this administration, what kind of material has he afforded you over the last couple years?
He's been a problem for satirists generally because— you know, despite all the shouting about him being a socialist or a fascist or whatever, the truth is he's a raging moderate, and he has such an even disposition, and he doesn't really have salient physical or temperamental features. So he's a little hard for us to get our arms around. And, you know, a plunging popularity just isn't a critique. There's not much to respond to. I mean, I wrote most recently about his lack of emotion, mm-hmm. Lack of emotion that he is so cool in his response to adversity, and you know, at one point he's being coached by one of his aides. He says, you know, the economy is just tanking. So, you know, don't tell me what you think about it. Tell me what you feel about it. What do you feel about it? He says, well, I feel like thinking about it.
Which has been their big critique about him more strongly in recent months than ever, I think, that he's a great communicator on the campaign trail, but maybe not so much as president.
Right, right. I mean, even Saturday Night Live, the best they've been able to do with him is they depict him as unflappable. But isn't mm-hmm. that what you might want in a world leader?
Right. You know, over the years, Gary, your characters have grappled with everything from AIDS to abortion to Alzheimer's, but you've really focused on the Gulf Wars and the struggles of returning soldiers who have been injured and maimed over there. What drew you to that as a storyline that you wanted to emphasize as much as you have over the years?
Well, I've been writing about military issues rather consistently, particularly since the first Gulf War. And so during the war, the second year of the war, during the first Battle of Fallujah, when the Marines were getting really torn up, I had a character, BD, who was pre-positioned there. And I thought, maybe it's time to really look closely at the nature of the sacrifice that we are asking of our countrymen. Mm-hmm. And I initially thought, well, maybe I might kill him. And I thought, well, that'll cause a stir for a week or two, and then everyone will forget about it. A much more, you know, a much richer possibility in terms of keeping the issue alive would be if he had a grievous wound, if he suffered a grievous wound. So there's a sequence of 4 days in which Beatty is wounded on the battlefield. And on the last day, the reveal, as we pull back, is to see him without his left leg, and just as conspicuously to longtime readers without his helmet.
Yeah,
and that was significant to readers, I think, because it signified that he had moved to a new place, that he was his life would never be the same again. And when that happened, I heard from some of my old friends at the Department of Defense, and they said, well, the Pentagon's looking they've been watching this unfold over the last 4 days, and they'd like to help you. And so they reached out, and they facilitated visits to Walter Reed and subsequently to VA hospitals and vet centers. So,
and you've been there a lot, to those hospitals.
A fair amount, and then subsequently on USO tours. So it's been a tremendous opportunity, and I think the reason that I jumped on it was that I thought, if I'm going to tell this story, it comes with a certain amount of real responsibility, and that the last thing you want to do is actually contribute to the pain that these individuals are undergoing. And so, you know, I decided, well, I better try to get it right, and so did far more research than I usually do. Usually, Google's good enough, you know. There's no time for more than that. And topical cartoonists go for, you know, verisimilitude at best, you know, what Colbert calls truthiness. You get the sense of something, you know.
But one reporter who's been with you on some of your hospital trips described you as really getting right down next to these soldiers and talking to them quite frankly about why are you here, what happened to you. You get right in their face.
Well, you can't not do that. I mean, when they're at that vulnerable point, fresh off the battlefield, they are their story. That's what they want to talk about. I mean, you might think not. You might think they would not want to revisit the trauma so quickly, but usually they do. There's two things they're preoccupied with. One is what's happened to them, and two, the repercussions, the most significant of which that's taken them away from their unit. They feel guilty. They feel crushed. They're not with their people.
They want to go back.
And, you know, you look at some of these folks, and they're missing sometimes more than one limb. They can be missing all of them. And still, that's foremost in their thoughts. You know, my buddies, I've somehow screwed up, and I can't be there for them.
Is it depressing?
Not at all. It's obviously you feel very you know, you're very moved by the sacrifice and very moved by their suffering, but they're inspiring mostly. They have that can do very forward leading military mindset still. You know, when I saw them in Ward 57, the amputee ward, and they're thinking about, they're just scheming as to how they can get back into the fray. And it just kind of takes your breath away.
You know, one soldier, Gary, you spoke to was an MP in her late 20s who was defending an Iraqi police station. She was up on the roof, which was stacked with sandbags, when she was hit. That woman clearly moved you. Tell us about her.
She was an MP. She was about 25, I'd say. She was a former basketball star at Notre Dame. Hmm. And this was early in the war when supposedly women were not being exposed to direct combat. Clearly she was. An RPG took off the lower part of her left arm. And her teammates rushed up onto the roof of the station and dragged her down, put her on the hood of a Humvee and tied her off, and then tied off the wound, and then her team leader rushed back on the roof and dug through the sand, found her hand, removed the ring from the hand, and brought it, her engagement ring, and brought it back down and put it in her good remaining hand. So she was so moved by that. That was her central memory. Was of not of bitterness or rage at her loss, but it was a story of soldier love. Hmm.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with Doonesbury's Gary Trudeau. And we'll turn to a partner of his for many, many decades, Don Carlton, who's been inking Gary's strip for years from his studio over in Fairway. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting with Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury fame. He's got a new book out, a retrospective of 40 years of Doonesbury. We're joined now by Don Carlton, who's a Fairway resident, and he's been inking Gary Trudeau's Doonesbury columns now for almost 40 years. He's the inker for Gary's work. And Don, it's nice to have you.
No, it's good to be here.
Welcome to the program. Let's talk about the process a little bit that takes place between you and Gary to produce Doonesbury 7 days a week. And Gary, you draw what? Everything but the color, or exactly what do you do?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
I do the inking. Gary works in very tight pencil drawings. He then faxes those to me, just an old-fashioned fax machine. Huh. I take them and put them on a light table and put a blank board, the drawing board, made of 100% rag content Strathmore Bond, and basically ink over them.
Are you tracing at that point?
Effectively.
Yeah.
Only minor non-tracing. Yeah.
Hey, how much back and forth do you two have in the course of a week talking about the strip itself?
Not a lot, thanks to fax machines and email. Well, we probably converse maybe once or twice a week on average.
Do you have any sort of suggestions on editorial content occasionally?
Almost none at all, and that pleases me greatly because I
no responsibility. Your hands are clean.
You might say that.
Yeah. Hey, how did you two meet, Gary? How did that happen?
Well, this was the first year after the first year of my strip, and I had I'd gone back to school. I was at an art school, in grad school, and I got a couple weeks into it, and I realized that there was no way that I could manage both the course load and a full-time profession. So I started talking to the syndicate about somebody who might be able to help me out, and Jim Andrews, my editor, found Don. I guess you were, doing some things for the syndicate already by that time?
I had been doing some nighttime work on the promotion for their features.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And so he put us in touch, and there's really no way I could have survived school without that. And of course, in those days, it was pre-fax machines, so I would have to assemble 4 to 6 weeks' worth of dailies, entrust them to the mails, and send them to Don, and then he would take them into the syndicate.
I'm not sure people understand exactly. So you create the strip, but what exactly? Why do you need an inker, Gary? What's that process all about?
Well, I do a very tight pencil drawing, obviously, because it's in pencil. I can erase as I go along, so I'm shaping the drawing, adding, subtracting. Finally, I have a final drawing. It's in light gray pencils, so it would not reproduce very well. So it needs to be inked over so that the lines are crisp and clean, particularly in those days when reproduction was not nearly as good as it is now. There would have been no alternative to having a final ink drawing.
Yeah. Well, Don, what kind of ride has it been for you? Because as we've talked, this strip took off pretty quickly and became something of a talk of the nation before too long, and you were part of that ride.
Well, I had never anticipated in my entire life I'd be doing what I'm doing now. I have a degree in art, but that doesn't exactly lead right to cartooning. So when Jim Andrews first showed me the pre-Doonesbury strips, he asked me my opinion of them, and I said it's a wonderful college comic strip, and et cetera, et cetera. Then Jim went ahead and
not a chance.
I think you're – maybe I said that.
Did you think it didn't have a chance at first?
I came from the newspaper world. I'd worked for 6 years at a daily newspaper down in Texas, so I kind of knew the milieu of editorial opinions and I knew the comics. I was a regular comic strip reader, so I knew that the comic page wasn't exactly an adventurous place historically. It was from that context only that I said, not a chance.
Well, really. Also there was, at that point, no tradition of really crudely drawn comic strips. That was new. I introduced that. I made the world safe for, the Kathys and Dilberts of the world.
Well, it's been said the drawing isn't the strength of the strip, right? It's the editorial.
It's been said by me and repeated by many.
Yeah, yeah. And so you didn't think it had much of a shot going forward, Don?
No, I wasn't alone in that opinion. I'm happy to note, but very happy that I was wrong. Very happy that I was wrong. By the time I think I met Gary, it was in about 150 papers. This was a year later, and that was a success in those days for sure. So Jim had kind of been the interlocutor between me and Gary and had set up a meeting at Jim's house, and we met, I think, for a total of 15 minutes, shook hands, and I went home and told my wife, Joan, that I think I've agreed to do something that I don't think is going to work out.
Well, do you occasionally get a strip from Gary and you know it's going to create some sparks across the country and sort of shake your head and think, okay, here we go?
You know, frequently I've been wrong in that. Yes, I make those judgments, and I've frequently been wrong. Those things which I see as dangerous frequently aren't, and vice versa.
Have you had favorite strips of Gary's over the years?
Yes, I have. People have asked, what's your favorite character? You know, I used to say right. BD because his hair is easy to draw. I couldn't see it. Well, that's gone by the wayside. I think the Reverend Scott Sloan, for whatever reason, the fighting young priest who talks to youth, is probably my favorite because I had seen that kind of pretension in the late 60s, early 70s.
Who gets the strip first, Don? Is it you or your editor, Lee Salem? Or?
Well, now it's simultaneous. And so far as Gary, I believe you fax the your roughs to the editor.
Only when I'm sure that it's the final version, yeah. Okay. I will send them fax them also to the syndicate so that they have something to compare it to when the art comes in.
What does an editor do with a comic strip? Edit the strip.
The same thing my current editor, Sue, does the same thing that Jim used to do, which was save me from myself.
Mm-hmm.
And everything from copy editing sorts of mistakes to factual errors that are unintentional.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, you were telling me, that one of the strips. Oh, I know what it was. It was the White House, and I had somebody talking to Ari. What I meant was Rahm.
Oh,
Emanuel. Oh. Ari is his brother.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a huge mistake. It would make no sense to readers.
Yeah.
But the astute editors at the Syndicate caught that one.
William writes us this, Gary. Did you ever deal with the Muhammad cartoon issue? Has he refrained from such references?
No, I didn't wade into that issue. I think my view at the time was that it didn't seem like it was something I wanted to add fuel to the flames of. I mean, it was people were dying around the world. And the strip is syndicated around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I backed off of it thinking that I probably would get back to it at some point. I think basically because you can do something, and certainly the First Amendment allows us to do a great deal,
right.
Doesn't mean you should or that you must. And we also don't run cartoons that are stereotypical cartoons about Jews and blacks in this country. That would also be scandalous.
Right.
There are all kinds of things we don't do, even though we could. So I was not as sympathetic as some of my peers were.
We have an email here from Mary Lee in Baldwin City, Kansas, Gary, and she writes, could Gary Trudeau clear up a mystery when Joni Caucus leaves her unfulfilling first marriage and embarks on a journey of self-discovery? Some mention is made of her leaving the kids behind. Later, a grown daughter, JJ, shows up and becomes a major character in the strip, but no other child or children are ever mentioned. Was this simply an oversight, a casualty of the rapid-fire nature of strip writing, or a conscious decision to buck the children reference and simplify things by having JJ be Joni's only child? This is the kind of dissonance that keeps editorial types like me awake at night.
Well, there's a third alternative, which is I completely forgot there was more than one child. That was a passing reference in one strip many years ago, and by the time I revisited the story, I had forgotten that I said she'd had children plural.
Mm-hmm.
So it really wasn't editorial judgment or to simplify my life. It's one of many, many inconsistencies that plague the strip. And sometimes I'll have characters meet who have already met,
mm-hmm.
and somebody has to point out to me that this is...
Hey, they've already met.
They've already met.
Don, you've noted that Charles Schulz said to Gary that comic strips should not be done by committee and that Doonesbury is pretty much a one-way process. When you get the panels, we've talked a little bit about this. What needs to be done, or does he just send notes along with the strip when you get it, or is there anything accompanying the actual art that Gary sends you?
No, it's a very tight rendering, so there isn't much need for notes. Although Gary does occasionally write me notes in the margin of this or that, something to pay attention to.
Saying what, the facial expression maybe, or
you know, facial expressions are very That's a very strange world because I think of the mouth and the eye and the eyebrows. You have about a stroke, ink stroke about an eighth of an inch long, and yet it can mean a whole lot and the subtleties of that. So Gary has Gary now sees the strip for a few seconds before it has to be to the editors or before they release it. So occasionally those will be modified slightly, but no, I don't think there is.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. There's such a limited visual vocabulary. You're using so few elements to create a wide range of emotions.
Yeah.
And so occasionally I will write back to Don and I'll send it back to him, or I'll just send him an email saying, Mark's looking a little too severe, or he's looking a little too giddy. Adjust the eyebrow just so, or, you know, the mouth just so. And it's an amazingly subtle process.
Yeah. Well, Gary, this notion of Charles Schulz once saying that strips should not be done by committee, he's saying what? That it's your baby, Bucko, and you run with it yourself, right?
Yeah. Schulz was a one-man band. He did everything. And I think it hardly constitutes a committee to have an assistant. Almost all other cartoonists of some who had some success did have assistants. Even the great Walt Kelly had wonderful inking assistants. And I've seen the undersketching, the blue pencil that Kelly drew in, and sometimes he's just blocking it out. So he trained them well, and then he gave assistants a lot of latitude.
What kind of relationship did you have with Charles Schulz?
Well, very distant. He lived in Santa Rosa in California, and I lived in New York, and he hated flying. So he was never at anything. He rarely came to cartoonist gatherings. I did go to visit him very early in my career, in the first year. I made a kind of
pilgrimage
to him and a few other respected cartoonists like Milt Caniff. And he was very generous with his time. I'm sure he had no idea what to make of the strip and didn't for years. I think he thought I was introducing a new language and new subject matter in a place where it didn't belong. And I think that was what he felt in his heart. He was always very sweet to me and very civil to me. But I think in his heart he really thought Dinsbury belonged on the editorial page.
Let's go to Jim from Prairie Village. Jim, you're on the program.
Hi, I just wanted to say hello and kind of reintroduce myself. I was at Mr. Trudeau's apartment some 15 years ago or so for an anniversary that Andrews McNeil was having and doing a kind of a overview of a number of their artists. And he was very, very gracious in letting us into his apartment with a large camera kit and light kit and no elevator and some weary, exhausted Midwestern travelers were really made to feel welcome and at home at this busy man's apartment that was, you know, it's an experience I'll remember and have told my kids about many times. He was just a very gracious host.
Oh, well, thank you for saying so. I appreciate that.
Jim, thank you. Let's go to Jason from Overland Park. Jason, you're on Up to Date with Gary Trudeau. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Well, thanks.
All right. Yeah, I was just curious if one of the reasons that a lot of cartoonists have been steering from kind of mocking President Obama is that they fear of being labeled a racist. And I bring that up in context of you could draw George Bush as a monkey and there was nothing wrong with it. But I believe there was a cartoonist who drew Obama as a monkey and was instantly attacked saying he was a racist, even though that really didn't have anything to do with that.
Oh, that's a good question. I think in that particular case, the monkey imagery obviously grew out of a stereotype, and that's not how, you know, Bush did not have to fend off similar stereotypes. I would say that in general, cartoonists haven't really pulled their punches because of that. I hear nobody ever talking about it. I think he has become another politician for us. And in the beginning, there might have been some early challenges, and people thought, well, how do I caricature him? How do I describe him? Most cartoonists settled on big ears and, you know, this skinny guy. But I haven't really heard anyone talk about it in recent months.
Let's go to Dave from Overland Park. Dave, you're on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. This is a great show.
Thank you.
My question was, who is his favorite cartoonist? That would be my overriding question today.
Well, all of us were really greatly influenced by Charles Schulz, obviously. I mean, he influenced a whole generation of cartoonists. But my particular source of inspiration was a cartoonist named Jules Pfeiffer, who was doing a weekly strip for the Village Voice through the 50s and 60s, and then he became syndicated as well. His I'm not sure how many people listening to this would be familiar with his style, but he would draw, he would repeat the images one after another of a face or of a character standing, without panels, without balloons, with layers of verbosity. I mean, all, just the dialogue was off the charts. And everything about the strip said, this strip is about ideas. It's not about gags. You might get a gag at the end. Mm-hmm. You might get a sort of a wry, you know, amused aside. But it was mostly about the little journey, the little play that he was writing. And I thought, that's such an interesting idea. This is taking comics in a place they've never been before. And so I think in the beginning I rather slavishly mimicked that style until my own emerged. Jules claims that he sees no similarity in our styles, but I pay him respect whenever I have an opportunity.
You know, you're the son, Gary, of four generations of physicians. How did your parents feel about you sort of breaking the streak here?
Well, my father was particularly sympathetic because he almost broke the streak himself. He was hoping to go to the State Department, be a diplomat, and he was wounded during World War II. And while he was recovering in a field hospital in North Africa, he had this epiphany, and he said, "No, I'm supposed to do the work that my family has always done." And so he returned to the small town I grew up in and became the next generation country doctor. But I think because he himself had tried so hard to get out from underneath the shadow of his father and his grandfather, he was sympathetic to my efforts. He was skeptical that cartooning constituted an actual career. I think he kept waiting for it to be over and for me to move on to something else. Once I got real traction and got up and running and you know was making more than he was,
yeah,
I began to gain some respect and he began enjoying being the father of.
Did he really once say life is not something to be enjoyed, so just get on with it?
A version of that, you know.
Yeah,
and he. He actually enjoyed life tremendously, so it was an odd thing to fall out of his mouth. It's just that he thought foremost you meant your responsibilities. That's what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And he had that ethos of the country doctor. He's almost a kind of social calling. And, it was before Medicaid and Medicare and before insurance companies really got involved in a big way. And so like many country doctors, he was working for free a lot of the time, and our piano at home would fill up on the holidays with jams and smoked trout, and there would be all piled up there. I remember people who knew they owed Doc something, but really didn't have the means to come through. Having said that, he lived a very comfortable life.
Yeah.
And he was not an ascetic, and he enjoyed his vacations and the rest of it. But he did think that that privilege, and he thought, growing up in a comfortable family entailed privilege, came with real responsibilities and commitment.
Gary, as Steve writes us an email, how does the rise of the internet affect cartooning? How has the decline of newspapers affected your circulation? And what's the future look like?
Well, it looks a little grim, I got to say. I mean, we're all struggling to figure out what reinvention looks like. And the web has not actually been all that friendly to webcomics. Most people have day jobs. So we've got to figure out a different way forward.
Yeah. Well, Gary, it's been a pleasure to have you. Don, thanks so much for coming in.
Steve Kraske spoke with Doonesbury cartoonist Gary Trudeau in 2010. Trudeau's latest book is Red Rascals War. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Up to Date had help this week from KCUR's Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Suzanne Hogan, Kim Noble, Peggy Lowe, Maria Carter, and Bill Anderson. I'm Steven Steigman, and you are up to date.